Hey, and today I get to talk to you about a subject that is always the most difficult for me. It is the thing that I have basically felt hanging over us for my entire adult life. But I wanted to talk about Tri-Valley Cares, which was founded in 1983 in Livermore, California, by concerned neighbors living around the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of two locations where all U.S. nuclear weapons are designed. Tri-Valley Cares monitors nuclear weapons and environmental cleanup activities throughout the U.S. nuclear weapons complex. With a special focus on Livermore Lab and the surrounding communities, Tri-Valley Cares works to strengthen global security by stopping the development of new nuclear weapons in the U.S. and by promoting the elimination of nuclear weapons globally. My guest is the executive director of Tri-Valley Cares, Scott Yund. He first joined Tri-Valley Cares as a legal intern in 2003, and then he became their staff attorney in 2009. And in that role, he managed the group's Community Right to Know program, including Freedom of Information Act activities from initial requests through litigation. He also facilitated a support group for Department of Energy nuclear workers and contractors made ill on the job by exposures. And he helped individual workers make claims for benefits and compensation. While continuing at those program areas, Scott also now works to stop new nuclear weapons proposed at Livermore Lab, new bomb plants proposed by the federal agencies to build those weapons, and the program to monitor and expose the nuclear weapons activities and the environmental cleanup at Livermore Lab. I think, Scott, I won't go into your education, but you are an attorney and you are very much appreciated for the pro bono work you've done and the public interest law that you have done. Thanks for being my guest today on the Peace and Justice Program. Hi.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, these are scary times, and I want to start off by admitting that and not getting too much into how rattled it makes me feel to think about it. But in November, you went to the Nevada test site with member groups of the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, a national network of organizations of communities with nuclear weapons complexes like Livermore that addresses issues about nuclear weapons production and environmental cleanup. And Tri-Valley Cares, of course, is a member. Is there a realistic concern about this current administration that they will resume nuclear testing? And maybe just very briefly, tell us a little bit about nuclear testing and why this is so worrying, what Trump is going on about with testing.
Sure. So the U.S. conducted roughly 100 atmospheric and 828 underground explosive nuclear tests at the Nevada test site, which is now known as the Nevada Nuclear Security Site. And we did all of that testing between 1951 and 1992. And it had a major impact on the environment, on the health of humans living downwind of those tests. And it should be noted that the Nevada test site is on sacred lands of the Western Shoshone Indian tribe, who joined us when we were there in November. And currently, the federal government keeps the site on what's called readiness status, which means that they maintain testing facilities that could be ready in 2 or 2.5 years or so to conduct a full-scale underground explosive nuclear test. All of the 1,054 explosive nuclear tests that have been conducted by the U.S., because we also did some in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific and one in Alaska and a couple others, were actually led by Lawrence Livermore or Los Alamos National Laboratories. So that's in particular why I pay attention to the testing situation. Livermore Lab conducted actually 46 above ground atmospheric tests, including the largest nuclear test the U.S. ever conducted, known as Castle Bravo in the Marshall Islands, which resulted in the forced removal of Marshallese people off of some of their islands after allowing them to get exposed. And I encourage people to look into that history. It's particularly a gruesome moment in U.S. nuclear history. But as we took tests underground we ended that program in 1992 and have since then been observing the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. So to answer your question, if there's a realistic concern about potential resumption of explosive nuclear testing, I also want to note that we already test our nuclear weapons delivery vehicles, so our airplanes, our submarine launched missiles, and our intercontinental ballistic missiles without the nuclear warheads attached. And that's similar to what other nations do, and we continue and are allowed to do that under the CTBT, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Some of those are conducted out of California, which we can talk about more. Mm-hmm. But we also do conduct what's known as subcritical nuclear tests, which just means they do not reach a critical yield in Nevada National Security Site. So, you know, to say we don't conduct nuclear tests would be kind of wrong. We just don't conduct what's known as explosive tests because those are banned by the treaty. But Project 2025 gave a hint that the Trump administration would potentially push for resuming explosive nuclear tests. It said that the U.S. should reject ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which we've never ratified it, and indicate a willingness to conduct nuclear tests in response to adversaries' nuclear developments if necessary. Mm-hmm. But this would require the National Nuclear Security Administration to move toward immediate testing readiness. And as I mentioned before, we currently, or for the last decades, have been maintaining a 2.5-year readiness. And so Project 2025 indicated we would move to immediate ability to conduct the test, which would be a major change. And then earlier this week, the administration accused China of conducting a nuclear test in 2020 that test exceeded the bounds of the CTBT, meaning there was some amount of criticality or explosive yield to it. Despite these claims, the accusation has not been independently verified by any international monitoring agencies, and China denies it. And the timing of this accusation, right after the expiration of the New START treaty, in which the U.S. claims they want to make a treaty with China instead and Russia, this timing is suspect, and it's clear that it's an attempt to lay the foundation to claim that the U.S. could conduct more nuclear tests. Mm-hmm. I want to mention, though, that the Livermore Lab and Los Alamos have maintained that there is no scientifically credible reason to conduct an explosive nuclear test. To do so would purely be political. However, they are developing new nuclear warheads, as you mentioned, and delivery vehicles. So they might change their narrative, I expect, to start arguing that testing might be needed to certify these new warheads. But the current understanding is that resumption of testing would open the door to all of the other nuclear states conducting their own tests, all of them testing their existing warhead designs, those that are in development. And that could potentially open the door to decades of nuclear tests around the world and the associated releases of radiation into the environment. And it should be noted that China would benefit more from this because they've conducted fewer tests, so they would learn the most from new testing data. Mm. And this would really have an explosive force, excuse the pun, for amplifying an already supercharged nuclear arms race.
Right, and I was listening to this show, and it's talked about the European NATO countries are talking about having their own nuclear weapons now, and I think the United States, I don't know how many people realize that we have the nuclear capacity we already have. I don't want to ask you more about testing, but I know that we have at least 400 underground silos across 5 states that would be available for use in a full-scale nuclear war? I mean, what threat does the United States pose to the rest of the world besides the crazy decisions to withdraw from treaties and, you know, and to push this kind of illogical move forward?
Well, the United States has been particularly provocative in the world of nuclear weapons, really since 2010 and 11, when the Obama administration was negotiating in the U.S. Senate to get the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or New START Treaty, ratified. And a deal was struck at that time that put the country on a path to modernizing our nuclear weapons stockpile. And since then, this modernization plan has really ballooned into the biggest government undertaking in scope and cost since the Manhattan Project, or the National Highway Program. We're committing to $2 trillion in projects over 30 years, which we're already about 10 years into, to develop all new nuclear warheads and all new delivery vehicles for the nuclear triad. So that means airplanes or bombers that deliver nuclear weapons, new submarines to deliver, which are nuclear powered, and a whole new generation of intercontinental ballistic missiles, which you pointed out. We currently have 400 underground silos across five states in the American West. The new ICBM program, which is called the Sentinel, is the costliest element of the nuclear modernization plan. And Livermore Lab is developing the brand new warhead for the Sentinel missile, known as the W87-1 warhead. Northrop Grumman is developing the missile portion. That part alone is estimated to cost $141 billion. So the weapons contractors, you know, are just frothing at the mouth for all of these project dollars. And the project will include building at least 400 new silos. Now that the treaty is expired, that kind of controlled how many nuclear weapons we can have, there's already talk of building even more, maybe 450. And these will take about 20 years to complete. And in the meantime, we have to continue maintaining the existing ICBMs, which are called Minuteman III's. And those are currently the ICBMs that we test out at Vandenberg Space Force Base in Lompoc, California. And these tests, which are shot out of Vandenberg, are actually shot to the Marshall Islands twice a year and demonstrate to our adversaries the strength of our ICBM leg. And we also can, as I mentioned, test submarine missiles. We test our airplane launchers. And we're going to be doubling down because we're going to test the old systems and the new systems simultaneously over the next couple of decades, the old systems to make sure they still work correctly and the new systems to make sure they're going to work correctly. So to our adversaries, we are majorly increasing our testing. We're spending a huge amount of money. And the threat to them, mainly China and Russia, is that they must likewise build up their new systems and modernize. And all of this happens at an immense expense to the people of these countries. And these tests increase the likelihood of a miscommunication or a miscalculation or a mistake that could potentially lead to nuclear exchanges or nuclear war.
So this is the Peace and Justice Program. My guest is Scott Yund. He is the Executive Director at Tri-Valley Cares in Livermore, California, at the Lawrence Livermore Labs, adjacent to. Scott, it's 85 minutes to midnight now, according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. They just moved that clock up. Can you describe what that means in light of what you just said? It makes sense that the nuclear risk is greater than ever.
Yes, so Chris, it's even worse. It's actually 85 seconds.
Oh, I put 85 minutes. Oh, gosh, sorry.
That's all right. Yeah, I wish it was 85 minutes. That would indicate a much better situation.
Oh, dear.
So the doomsday clock is something the scientists who are involved in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists from many fields do a very thorough job of analyzing what the threats are facing humanity to potential self-destruction. And so these are existential threats like climate change and dangerous technologies and pandemics. But really the main factor in their analysis for decades has been the threat of nuclear weapons proliferation and nuclear war. And the doomsday clock reflects that right now there is an extremely high level of global risks associated with all of these threats, but in particular this year, an increase in the threat of nuclear exchange. And this is actually the closest to midnight scientists have ever made the clock. And it's really a tool to bring more attention to these threats. And there's been thousands of news stories written and articles in response. And it's really to get people talking about the problem. And even leaders like members of Congress and UN delegations bring up the clock. You know, it's often talked about as something that scares people, but it should really be just a clarion call that our scientists who are paying attention to this believe we're on the wrong path toward a potential doomsday situation. And, you know, we should take it as a call to action.
Right. And although supposedly we're using this for detente, what we're really using this for is for corporations to get rich by building them. And I was wondering about treaties, because the New START treaty expired last week, and Russia has said they're going to keep their levels of nuclear weapons and not increase them. But the pundits were saying that there's no point. Well, this is what the administration said, and the pundits just echoed it in mainstream media, that it was okay to lapse the New START treaty because it didn't include China, so why bother? Can you talk a little bit about geopolitics of the new arms race? Because there are, what, 9 nuclear nations right now, and it obviously is ballooning. It's very scary. Can you talk about the geopolitics, please?
I think the risk that we're all like feeling in our gut right now and thinking about is that we have what amounts to a rogue or mad authoritarian leader in our own country and in Russia potentially, who both have sole authority to launch nuclear weapons at any moment and without really any oversight. Not just do they have sole authority, but we have weapons on hair trigger alert that results in a system where within roughly a half an hour, decisions have to be made whether to engage in a full-scale nuclear war, even if just one missile was launched. I recommend folks watch the recent film that's available on Netflix called House of Dynamite, where this kind of scenario is played out in real time, and it gives you a real feeling for how much reliance we have in our leaders when it comes to nuclear weapons. And when we have nuclear command and control systems that are based on a theory of deterrence that relies on rational decision making, and we have leaders who don't feel like they make rational decisions, there's kind of a global reckoning that rationality in world superpowers is not reliable anymore. And then we have this problem of the bilateral treaties that have been in place now for decades. I mentioned New START came into effect in 2010, but it was a follow-on treaty that dates back all the way to 1972. And so since 1972, we've had treaties that controlled the number of nuclear weapons we could have strategically deployed, although not how many we have in reserve. And we've had treaties that allowed for inspection, for verification, and for communication and cooperation between Russia and the United States. And this is important because Russia and the United States still account for 86% of all the nuclear weapons and 83% of the warheads deployed for military use. China is really a distant player with only 600 nuclear weapons compared to roughly 6,500 in Russia and the United States. So, but New START capped the strategically deployed number at 1,550 for both countries, a cap that would be irrelevant to China because they only, as I mentioned, have 600 nuclear weapons. So this argument that we should let New START expire because we need to bring China into this treaty regime is flawed based on this kind of cap that is there. Even if we lower the cap between the U.S. and Russia, it's not going to get anywhere near as low as 600 at the present. So continuing to observe that cap is very important. But I might argue that what is more important is not the cap, but is the communication framework that facilitates cooperation and stability between the two major nuclear weapon states, including the verification, which involves third parties like the International Organization for the IAEA or the Atomic Energy Association, that's a UN agency. And we have none of that now. So not only do we not have a cap, but we have no formal communication channels. We have no verification mechanisms. And that's where I think the real dangers lie. We also have an administration that let go all of the experts in the State Department who would be the experts that would negotiate a treaty. An international treaty is not a real estate deal that can be, you know, written on the back of a napkin. And this current administration seems to think it can make a quick deal here, but this involves very complex multinational organizations, and treaties are complicated. They're not just a deal. And unfortunately, we're now in an era where there's no restraint. I fear there's no experts in the room. And without a new multilateral framework, the risk of escalation and miscalculation and global arms race just continues to grow. Yesterday, Russia said it would respect the New START treaty limits as long as the U.S. does, which is a hopeful sign. Unfortunately, there has been no response yet from our administration, and still they seem committed to wrapping China in, yet China has said it is not interested.
So, Scott Yuan, we're out of time, but I want to make it so you have 2 or 3 minutes, because I want you to just briefly talk about the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons and what Tri-Valley Cares is doing, and just try to draw people in, so because we need to build a grassroots movement like we had in the 80s. There's much to be done, and you have 2 minutes to tell us about it.
Sure. So there is a bright light of the Treaty of the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, with which most Americans don't even know about because our media blacks it out and we are not a party. But there are over 70 nations that have ratified it, including Ghana, which just ratified in September 2025. So there's still momentum. They're going to have a review conference in 2026. It's led by the Global South. It recognizes the humanitarian impacts of nuclear weapons and war, and it is a bright light in the hope for nuclear disarmament that the U.S. should start paying attention to. I will be there. Hopefully it will be inspiring. Groups are doing a lot these days to try to bring attention to and curb nuclear dangers. Back from the Brink, which we're a membership organization, I encourage people to check that out. We have a California resolution coming up that Assembly and Senate members in the state can join. There's going to be a public comment period on a plutonium pit production public environmental impact statement people can comment on. That's a great way to get involved. If people can check out the Tri-Valley Cares website and join us there. Check out Back from the Brink. Continue to speak truth to power. And I realize there's a lot going on. So, you know, let's find ways to have intersection. You know, no kings, no new nuclear weapons. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk today, Chris.
And you were right. We did need more time. So I apologize for that, Scott. You know, you are doing an amazing job, and I appreciate you just to no end. Thank you so much for everything you're doing for our planet to try to save it.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.